Welcome to Friday. Welcome to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We're about to analyze the news of the week, and we're doing it with an audience at the Northgate Community Center. Hey! Welcome, everybody. Seattle is about to start electing city council members, not just citywide, but mostly by neighborhood districts. And we are in District 5. We're going to say more about North Seattle in a moment. What a week to be a liberal. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court extended same-sex marriage to all 50 states, something Washington has already embraced. Yesterday, the court upheld Obamacare, something Washington has already embraced. Even the Confederate flag is coming down, and the former head of our state Republican Party, Chris Vance, was supposed to be here, and he's not here yet, and he might be scared.
Oh, indeed.
He's stuck in traffic, and he's on his way, so let's talk about our home for the next hour, North Seattle. As I mentioned, we are electing city council members by district, and we had our reporter, Joshua McNichols, profile District 5, and one of the notable things about this area, it turns out, is how unwalkable it is.
So here we are in an area now where there's no sidewalks. You see the woman coming down the street, walking on the shoulder, but inside the fog line. And because of the poor infrastructure, when it really rains, the shoulders fill up with water. So then you really have to get into the street or you get your feet wet.
That lack of sidewalks is a huge issue up here. On a map showing Seattle streets with no sidewalks, the whole north end of Seattle is lit up red. Red meaning danger.
Why is North Seattle so unwalkable? One of our panelists this hour is former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. Hey, Mike McGinn.
Glad to be here.
As you were just telling me, you were chair of the Northwest Council here. These are your people?
Well, I was never chair of the Northwest District Council, but I was president of the Greenwood Community Council for years.
Uh-huh.
And I live just north of 85th, but by a fluke of district line drawing, I'm across the street from District 5. But
they gerrymandered you out of here.
Well, who knows? Who knows what they were thinking? But, you know, my buddy Richard Dykster, who's up here in Bitter Lake, refers to the area north of 85th and this side, the other side of Aurora, as lesser outer Seattle territories northwest, or lost northwest. And he's been a wonderful advocate. And up there in Bitter Lake, on Linden Ave, we put a lot of money into that. And that was my entry into local politics. I moved to Greenwood, and I could not walk to the Safeway safely with my little kid for exactly the reasons that were being described earlier. And I just set to work trying to organize my neighbors, trying to figure out how things worked. And it turned out that if you wanted to get sidewalks, you just had to get more and deeply involved into transportation. So that's always my warning to anybody working on sidewalks up on the north end. You just don't know what's going to happen if you start working on sidewalks.
That's how you get sucked in. Seattle Channel host Joni Balter is here. Hey, Joni.
Hey, good morning.
What is North Seattle to you?
Well, I live in the South End, and I just have very nice memories of I had two sports-active children, and as you know, all you parents who had children in basketball and baseball and all the rest of it, you travel around, and so you're on all the different fields and in the community centers, just like this one, watching your kids play, and so I do have very, very nice memories of all of that.
And you do have lovely ball fields here.
But also, you know, I also like the single-family neighborhoods, some of the multifamily neighborhoods, the density that's coming, just the fact that this neighborhood, it's changing along with the rest of Seattle, hopefully in a good way.
Yeah, well, we're going to talk actually more about that in a bit, but what about how, I've heard from audience members before the show, we love North Seattle the way it is, and it's changing. So is North Seattle going to be, you know, Columbia City, going to be... Where? It's going to be Ballard. Where's North Seattle headed as the whole city takes off?
Well, one of the stories that KUOW had talked about how North Seattle, Lake City, would like to be more like Columbia City, and I live very close to Columbia City, and it's quite something to watch the change that has come there. For example, Seward Park, there are so many new babies coming along. There are so many young people moving into the neighborhood. And as a result, the Columbia City Business District is changing, perhaps like this neighborhood will.
One fellow here was telling me about how this is an affordable place, relatively speaking. So we're going to get the same moves that the whole city has seen. You can't afford to live in Capitol Hill, maybe you come to Haller Lake.
I mean, it depends where you live in the North End, but there's, you know, both in the North End and the South End, there are these big arterials just cutting right through the neighborhoods that are really hostile to walking, very unpleasant to be around, and they cut through neighborhoods like Greenwood, like Lake City. You know, Aurora Ave is an example. And, you know, for a long time, I think the North End has been treated as the place that is passed through on the way to downtown. But there are people in these neighborhoods going, hey, we live here. So that's one of the fights. One of the things I discovered as mayor was that if you live in a neighborhood, you want your streets calm in your neighborhood, and you want the streets in the other neighborhood to be nice and fast for you to drive through, right? I mean, literally. I mean, I can give you specific examples of a town hall one night where Magnolia was complaining to me about how a road in Queen Anne needed to be wider, and Queen Anne folks were saying the road needed to be more calm for pedestrians. And I think we're going to see with districts and with local organizing around safety and the relatively new embrace of walking and maybe even biking and transit, that there's going to be dramatic changes ahead that will make these places more livable. And, yeah, more people are going to want to live here because they can't afford to live closer. Absolutely.
Well, let's say more about growth. First of all, I want to remind you, the listener, that you can talk to us on Twitter, at KUOW right now. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. So let us know what you're thinking about. And let's roll right into the topic of growth, because this week Seattle's current mayor, Ed Murray, announced a new strategy for city planning, creating a new planning office for community concerns about, quote, how we preserve the Seattle that drew us all here in the first place. Okay, preserve. How do we preserve? Meanwhile, this week, one of the members of Murray's Housing Affordability Committee said the committee will advise that all neighborhoods must accept more density. No one is exempt, end quote. How in the world do you simultaneously densify and preserve, Joni Balter?
Well, that does sound like a very tall order and very difficult to do. One of the reasons I think the mayor came up with this new office, I mean, the obvious reason, growth needs to be coordinated. At least the city has to have some ability to coordinate all the different things that...
What are you saying,
requires.
The former mayor wasn't coordinating?
Oh, he was so coordinated. But in addition to that, I also think that the mayor knows that when he goes out to some of these neighborhoods, he hears from some folks who go there talking endlessly about, you know, growth could really change Seattle, not so much for the better, but for the worse. And there's a fear of that. There's a legitimate fear of that. And I think as a mayor, he knows that if he doesn't do something to get on top of growth, he likes to say, we have to get growth right.
So but what do you mean? What's he actually doing?
Well, he's got a department that's going to really kind of be all over it and be able to
tell
him.
What are they
going to
do? I mean, so well, he's reshuffling, he's streamlining. But what's he doing about growth that's any
different?
Well,
what he's doing is coordinating the services, because there's growth and then the growth that you didn't do anything with, or the fact that maybe you handled it well. But he knows this is an issue on which he shall be judged. He does know that.
Mike McGinn, what's your take? You've been in that chair.
Yeah, I have been. And I think there's always, I think, a sense that, boy, if we could just plan better in advance, it would all work out. And
More planning,
right. Well, we've kind of had a few decades of planning here, if not more. And we can kind of see the results. And I was thinking about this. If you think about some of our most loved neighborhoods, like, you know, Columbia City even, or places that are really walkable and beautiful, there were no neighborhood plans. There was, in fact, no zoning. They were built by people in response to the needs of the day. And somehow or another, we've layered on rules and regulations and plans, and it's not working out. And I think that it's good to try to coordinate planning. It's good to get people in the same room and working together. Some of that's not just a new agency. It's also, you know, actually compelling people to do it. And then it's how you execute and how you actually make it happen. There's planning and then there's the daily operations. And it's a tall order in a big city for any mayor. And absolutely, you should be trying to figure out how to coordinate better.
So my initial question was, how can you simultaneously densify and preserve? Well, I think give us an example of what would be good planning when you want to both preserve the Seattle that brought us all here in the first place and put density in every single neighborhood. No one is exempt.
Well, I think you have to take a look then at what are the values and qualities you're looking for, not the physical infrastructure you're looking for. And I actually read all 39 of the neighborhood plans back when. And I've read summaries of them. And the values you hear people speak about are parks and open space, walkability, small neighborhood good local neighborhood business districts, a sense of community. Those values are fairly consistent. They also want to make sure all the streets are free-flowing and there's plenty of parking for everybody. So there's a little cognitive dissonance there,
and
too.
And a free pony for everyone.
Right, right. There's
and
a little
sidewalks
bit of cognitive dissonance.
All.
But I think maybe the way you go at it is you have to focus on the values you want to preserve, not necessarily the physical infrastructure you want to preserve. And, that means investing in the things that improve quality of life, like transit, parks and open space, affordable housing,
so
public
who are you
art.
Saying no to?
You know, that's the thing about it. You do have to say no to people. And I think that...
Who gets said no to?
Well, everybody gets said no to a little. That's part of the challenge. But can you get to a point where you actually are delivering on some of the values and benefits? And, one thing you can try to say no to is new residents. No new apartments. Nobody can move in here. But that has consequences for affordability. Or you can say no to the people who said, well, I like my neighborhood just the way it is. I don't want to see it different. So somebody's going to get said no to in this process.
Okay, so if we were to, if growth weren't to happen here, if we weren't to, the reason we densify in urban areas is so we don't sprawl all over the place. And joining us now from the suburbs.
And a long ride.
He took a long traffic-laden drive to get here, is the former chair of the Republican Party in this here state, former council member and legislator Chris Vance. Welcome to the table.
There's really no excuse for being late. It's just rude. But the traffic sometimes, I left two hours to get from Auburn to Northgate today. There was a bunch of accidents. It's just awful, so I apologize.
Are you going to be grumpy the entire hour?
No, I'm not grumpy. But I've walked in on a discussion that I lived with for a long time. I was in the legislature when we passed the Growth Management Act. I was the chairman of the county council's Growth Management Committee when we implemented and passed the 20-year growth management plan for King County. And, Bill, what you said is the key to this. The key to growth management is to protect Enumclaw, you maximize the densities in Seattle. And in places like Federal Way and everywhere else. And that's the basic core value and idea of growth management. And it drives people crazy. Nothing makes people more upset than seeing more apartments in their neighborhood. But you can't meet the growth management goals that the state sets for each community without greater densities. And it happens not just in Seattle, but in every suburb. Where I lived, my first home, used to be horse pastures. And there were still some horse pastures in the periphery of the neighborhood, and the people who owned that land wanted to sell it to make money to build houses just like our houses. My neighbors literally came to my front door and said, "You got to stop this." I'm like, "What do you think was munching on grass in your backyard a few years ago?"
Right.
And we that neighborhood, you could see the Valley Freeway from our neighborhood. We were in the heart of the urban area. The idea of growth management is to make the urban urban and to protect the rural.
And I don't think there's any secret that sort of we use Columbia City as an example of something, of a place where things are going well. Well, Sound Transit is servicing that neighborhood. And eventually you guys, not too long, will have some of that as well.
Well, when I ask people about this, about density, what they can't stand about density, I often hear, "Oh, no, I'm not anti-density. It's just the way we grow." For example, it's blame the developers. It's the ugliness of the new apartment buildings. Why does growth have to be ugly?
So, I mentioned it earlier. When we look at all those really charming neighborhoods, if you look at ancient cities and old cities with charming neighborhoods, they didn't really have all the levels of zoning, design review, and regulations we had. So what did we do wrong? I think we kind of put the design of buildings in the hands of you know, developers, upset neighbors, and timid politicians. And that's really not the committee you want in charge of charm and beauty. And that's what we've ended up with.
You were mayor. Does the code say go ahead and build ugly buildings? I want to understand how that works. How do you make growth not ugly?
Yes, actually. The code, if you speak to most architects who really do take some pride in the buildings they build, what they will tell you is we build exactly what the code tells us to build. And in this city, very frequently let's take a look at Capitol Hill as an example, or Finney Ridge or other places. You know that old charming brick apartment building with the green courtyard, et cetera?
Oh, we love brick.
We love
brick
that.
Brick is charming.
You can't build that building today. Right. Today, what you'd end up with instead is something that a two-car wide garage entrance, a sunken garage to accommodate the cars.
Because you have to have parking when you put
depends.
In a new project.
That's been changing, and that's upset people, too. But those are the types of things. So we end up with boxy buildings instead of narrow storefronts that go deep, like a typical old business district. You got a shallow one because you got to accommodate all the movement of vehicles at the base level. There's a whole bunch of rules that inadvertently, with the best of intentions, with people working hard on it, tell people to build ugly buildings. And, you know, we kind of go back in and wade in again and tweak this and tweak that, and we end up with ugly buildings again. So
if we want brick, why don't we just say only brick buildings or have a committee
of
architects.
Have you ever
of
heard of earthquake troubles?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Maybe it's an earthquake thing. But, like, could we have an aesthetics committee that has to sign off on the gorgeousness of each building?
You can do some of that. In King County, when I was in the county council, we not only did big regional planning, but also neighborhood plans for the remaining urban areas that were unincorporated. I remember we did the High Line area community plan around the Burien community plan before it incorporated. The best you can do is try and get neighbors as much involved as possible through local level community planning. But property owners have rights, and if you try and restrict too much what developers can do with their rights, you get to the point where they're going to sue you and they're going to win.
Why? Why do they win?
Because they have rights. They have rights under the Constitution and the law to do. You cannot so restrict their use of their property that you're taking away their basic rights to own the property.
I think some of what you're hearing in Seattle has very much to do, not so much with ugly or not ugly, but with the pace of growth. And booms are like that. Booms don't have, you know, a slow, meticulous rollout. They happen really quickly. And so a lot of what I'm hearing from folks in this city is just it's going too much too fast. That's what folks are talking about.
So your answer to the question, how can we simultaneously densify and preserve, is we can.
It goes quickly, and you got to try to keep up with it, which is what I think the mayor's trying to do in some way.
Mayor Ed Murray announced this new strategy for city planning, creating this new planning office for community concerns about how we preserve the Seattle that drew us all here in the first place. Coming up on our Week in Review, you see a speed trap. Are you allowed to warn your fellow citizens of a speed trap? Some of you are nodding your heads. That and more, the top stories of the week, all to come on the Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter and Mike McGinn and Chris Vance. As I was saying at the top of the show, what a week for liberals. We had the Supreme Court upholding gay marriage, same-sex marriage in all 50 states. Which is something that we have already embraced, of course, here in Washington State. We also embraced the Affordable Care Act. We set up our own health exchange. That got upheld this week. Down south, even the Confederate flag is falling. We've got the former head of our state Republican Party, Chris Vance. Chris, you know we're coming for your guns next. Right?
Well, that is how conservatives think, is they see these things happening one after dominoes falling one after another, and they do wonder what's next.
Yeah, what do Republicans in Washington State, what do they have to be excited about right now?
Well, in the macro level, Republicans control 30 governorships, the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate, majority of state legislatures. The president's approval ratings are dismal.
I'd want to check those this week.
No, well, people Let's do that, because
let's
they are.
Do that. Yeah.
And the Affordable Care Act was found constitutional in a really tortured ruling, I think, but it doesn't make it popular. It's never been popular. It's not popular. And so I think the macro numbers for
is it going to our audience is turning on you is the Affordable Care Act going to get less popular or more popular like Medicaid and Medicare?
It's going to become far less popular because the elements that have kicked in already provide subsidized insurance for those who need it. The next steps, however, are things like the Cadillac tax on employers who provide generous health care for their employees. And it's going to end up beginning to interfere with the health care for people who already have it and like it. Look, Republicans struggle on the West Coast, the Northeast, but in the rest of the country are doing rather well. And, you asked about Republicans in Washington State.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of other problems there. So
Republicans are so relieved that Obamacare was upheld. They didn't have a plan.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Absolutely.
I think you're right. But now, again, they can tee off on it and talk about how we need to repeal it without actually proposing. Look, I've been very critical. I don't like the Affordable Care Act, but the Republican Party has not offered a single viable alternative to it, and they need to do that.
I think, though, if you look at I really appreciate the perspective Chris just offered on this, but if you look at where the pitchforks are going to come out in the next couple of years, I don't think it's going to be on the Health Care Act. It's around issues of inequity and inequality, and that's going to sweep up Democrats, too, as well as Republicans, I think, in the next few years.
By the way, that man talking is flaming liberal, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. Your city's liberal policies are so destructive that Seattle has the most roaring economy in America. Thanks a lot. What are you thinking about today?
About?
All the stuff that's going on. The Supreme Court,
the
income inequality, Seattle's growth, just... What do you see?
Boy, that's such a dangerous question. What are you thinking? And I really just
how much time do you have?
Thank you, Joni. But I think there are two things. One was realizing that the way that this decision came about on marriage reflected the personal courage of so many individuals who came out to their friends and families and employees, and that's what moved the debate. Right? It wasn't political maneuvering, and that happened, and it wasn't great advocacy, and that happened. It was really the courage of individuals to create change. And so that gives me a little bit of hope. On the other hand, I was kind of thinking, I was going to say, Chris, you guys got a big victory recently. Shell Oil managed to bring the Polar Pioneer into Elliott Bay with the support of the Port Commission, the governor, and the mayor, and then have it leave town. So, you know, we haven't turned the tide yet on climate, and I'm kind of hoping we can do that in the future. That's what I'm thinking right now.
Seattle Channel host Joni Balter, same-sex marriage is spreading. Legal marijuana is spreading. What's the next way America will imitate Washington State?
Well, one hopes on gun control because Washington has been at the forefront of many of these issues, and it took, you know, an initiative. So we're talking here about a lot of different issues in which the public is ahead of the government on. All the ones you mentioned. And sometimes the voters, they go out in front of the government. Can you imagine the Washington legislature doing anything on background checks? I can't.
Well, they don't have to. The people did. But
right.
I think
they wouldn't have.
The ruling today by the Supreme Court shows we live in a democracy in a true sense, that the people have made a decision on this issue. I've never seen an issue where the ground has shifted so rapidly. Just not very long ago, If there was even a hint of support for gay marriage, anybody who supported that was ridiculed. Now the overwhelming majority of Americans support it, and the Supreme Court has caught up with them.
But the people in Georgia didn't go for it. Antonin Scalia thinks this is undemocratic because the court didn't let Americans in their sovereign states do what they want to do.
Well, of course, the issue before the court was, is marriage a right protected under the 14th Amendment or something that states are allowed to regulate? And the court ruled, I think properly, it's a right protected under the 14th Amendment. But my point here is that these four conservatives who are conservative on cultural issues, a lot of these debates are over and been lost on those sides. And Republicans need to move on to other issues rather than marriage, marijuana, abortion, issues like that. I think Republicans need to be talking about the debt and the fact that our economy's not growing and the problems with the healthcare system and reforming the tax code and those sorts of issues, not The culture wars are over. Get over it.
I don't think the Supreme Court could have ruled any other way on gay marriage, just knowing this seismic shift in public attitude.
Exactly.
And also, if you watched or listened to some of the words that were used by Justice Kennedy in the April questioning, he was so definitely going this way, if you listen to it. He used words like nobility and fairness and all these kinds of words that he used to talk about. He had some other comments at that time that made some people confused, but it was clear to me watching that it was over. He was going to go this way, and he was the swing vote.
So Washington State was one of those early adopters by vote, by a referendum, by initiative for same-sex marriage and other things. So, Joni, you're saying running our government through voter-approved initiatives, that's the way to go, right? You love it.
No, I'm on record in a different way. I very much do not like budgeting by initiative. And the reason is, I can explain that, is that you're asked a single question in an initiative. But it has to go into the context of the entire state budget, which a lot of people will read and many others won't read. So how are you supposed to balance a budget? You know, if you ask somebody, do you want something, they want that something. It's very expensive. And we've run into that with class sizes and teacher pay and things like that many times now. People are going to say, yes, I want the goodie, but they don't have to balance the budget and come up with the money to pay for it. And that's what our state story tells you.
Yes, in a moment, we're going to talk about balancing a budget, the budget that doesn't exist in Olympia, still in almost July. That's when we come back on The Week in Review. Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review, today live from the Northgate Community Center in District 5, as we continue our summer tour of Seattle's new election districts. I'm Bill Radke. We're covering the big stories this week. Thousands of Washington State employees received notice that they might be laid off temporarily if a new state budget is not adopted in 3 days. Question one. What are the odds our government will shut down former state Republican chair and legislator Chris Vance?
They grow by the hour, literally. I've been involved in every legislative session since 1985 in one capacity or as another, either a staff person or a member of the House. I lobby a little bit now. Once you reach an agreement, once the House and Senate reach an informal agreement, it takes 2, 3, 4, 5 days to pass all the legislation to shut down the session and end the session. They passed that deadline last night. It is now almost physically impossible for them to adjourn by Tuesday. If they don't have a budget on the governor's desk by Tuesday night, we'll have the first state government shutdown in Washington state history. That's why I think the Senate introduced a bill yesterday to pass a one-month extension, just continue the current budget for 1 month. We've never done that here before. That's what they routinely do in Washington, D.C. with continuing resolutions because Republicans and Democrats can't talk to each other and make a deal. The partisanship and the gridlock in Washington, in Olympia now, is the worst I've ever seen it, and it is just as bad as it is in Washington, D.C., and everybody should be angry about that.
Joni, if they can just pass a continuing resolution and kick the can down the road, who cares? What's the big deal?
Well, first of all, I don't agree.
They'll get it done eventually.
They're going to get it done on time is a guess. I think that there's enough motivation to do that. Look, these guys, since the time the governor's budget was proposed and now, nearly a billion dollars more in money has come in because of the booming economy. This deal is within sight, and they just got to wrap it up and get it over with.
It's much more complicated than that. It's not just about money. It's about philosophy. There's a bunch of different items floating out there, rather not just how far apart they are in their two competing budgets, such as how they treat college tuition, how they deal with the governor's ability to do a clean fuel standards, whether or not they raise taxes at all. I know from what people I've talked to the past day or two, they are not close to an agreement. They're not even close to a formal agreement yet. So we're very close to a government shutdown.
Next question, who should we blame? I've got a finger and I want to point it.
Well, in my view, everyone.
I agree with that.
There's been a cultural shift in Olympia where Republicans and Democrats just don't or refuse to compromise with each other. Compromise means I give the other guy half of what he wants and I get half of what I want. And neither side seems willing to give up half a loaf. And they just the only thing they seem to be able to agree upon is to pass a budget that, as the House Majority Leader said this week, keeps the lights on, just keeps the government open. That's where we are in Washington, D.C., and we've been there for several years. And now apparently that's where we are in Olympia. Divided government is not new in Olympia. There's been many years when you've had Republicans control the House or the Senate and vice versa. But we could always talk to each other and reach deals. They can't do that now.
Chris Vance was a legislator. You know who was an executive? Former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. What lesson should we draw from our budget stalemate?
Well, I was at first going to say, oh, it's just brinksmanship, they'll make a deal. But Chris changed my mind here listening to him. They might. They might make a deal. And I worked for a congressman way back when Congress actually passed a majority of their budget through appropriations bills. And that's gone by the wayside. And that appears where we're heading here as well. You know, there are certain things you have to do. You have to have a budget. If you don't have a budget, there's a great deal of uncertainty for everybody who depends on that budget, right? The UW is deciding, you know, how many professors they can hire next year. Schools are deciding how many school teachers they can hire. Parks are trying to figure out whether they can be opened or closed. That level of uncertainty has a huge cost that creates a big impetus to get a deal.
And so this isn't just can kicking and so what? This has real consequences.
Even if you kick the can a month, what you're saying to a school, you know, a principal of a school, you know, what the superintendent of the district is saying to the principal, who's saying to the teachers, is I don't know how many of you I can have in my classrooms next year. Yeah, I just don't know. And this is the summer. You kind of want to know that.
The mayor's exactly right. I work part-time for the superintendent of public instruction. We're letting school districts know right now that they're not going to get their full apportionment check for July because the legislature's not approved it. That's approximately a $16 million cut to school districts across the state. Push that out another month, and it starts to get real. This is actually
going to hurt real. So you're admitting it's not real now then, right?
If they don't have a budget signed by Tuesday, the world's not going to come to an end, but it will have major impacts on real people. And the other big thing is they'll eventually get a budget, but they seem unable to reach agreement on any of the major structural issues like reforming our tax system or actually funding our schools in a constitutional way that need to get fixed. And maybe they'll get a transportation agreement. I don't know. But the inability for Republicans and Democrats to work together is troubling.
But I'm going to jump in here. You need a budget, right? I mean, that's like a basic. There are certain things you don't actually need. And I'd argue you don't need a transportation bill right now.
This second.
I needed it today.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
And Chris and I was going to say.
You needed it last week, too. But
no.
You'll get it.
But Chris made a point earlier about the role of debt, and maybe that's where Republicans should be going. You know, our state treasurer, McIntyre, warned the legislature that if you build all the new highways you want to build in that bill, all your gas tax is going to pay debt. You won't have any gas tax for maintenance. That's part of the ticking time bomb on debt that is being built. So I personally think they should, you know, shelve the transportation bill and come back with something that actually makes sense. But you need an operating budget.
Well, the transportation bill they're talking about doesn't just build freeways. It also authorizes Sound Transit Phase 3 and local option financing for metro and other forms of transit. Transit and roads are tied together in this package. We need this transportation
definition of log rolling and you know, pork barrel politics.
So everybody gets what they want.
But we
can't afford it.
And we can't afford it.
The mayor was making,
you got it.
Which I thought was important, is the budget has to be done by next week. The transportation can take a minute or two longer.
It's been 15 years.
That too.
Before we move on, we've just heard a lot of problems. Does anybody have a solution?
This sounds really simplistic, but the only solution is just Republicans and Democrats have to just decide that they're going to work together. And I served in the King County Council.
Oh, we just solved that problem.
Well, really, now, Bill, I served in the King County Council when there were 7 Republicans, 6 Democrats, and a Democrat executive. We accepted the fact that we had to negotiate and compromise and accept 50% of what we wanted, or nothing would get done. It's cultural. You just have to believe. And they've lost that culture.
How do we get it back?
I don't know. I mean, the voters need to demand it.
Well, I covered that council, and I remember you, Chris, and there were a couple of you, along with Rob McKenna, folks who did come to the middle and make it work in the middle.
And it worked.
And it sometimes worked, absolutely.
Last word, Mike McGinn?
You know, I think, Chris, the the most important point Chris just made was, you know, the voters have to demand it. So although pointing figures and deciding blame is often feels like a pretty useless exercise, it is important to cover what is the nature of the difference between the sides, you know, who is being more obstinate, and the voters are going to have to make some decisions in the next set of elections as to who they think is being reasonable. And that's okay. I know we all want our politicians to get along, but I don't think in the future, you know, our kids are going to say, wasn't it great that all the politicians got along? They're actually going to want to know, did they address and fix the problems in a reasonable way? And those philosophical differences are real differences mm-hmm. in approach. It's not just a failure to get along.
The Washington State Legislature has until midnight Tuesday to finalize a budget, not just agree, but to actually get everything done, or else the state government shuts down unless there's a continuing resolution, and then we have the problem just goes into July instead of June. 25,000 state employees have received furlough notices. Coming up, we're going to talk about who is overseeing this tunnel project. If anyone.
You are, Bill.
And then we're going to mock Chris Vance, who just came here from a traffic jam, by talking about a speed trap. That's all coming up on the Week in Review. Live at the Northgate Community Center, we're learning from the news of the week. I'm Bill Radke on KUOW. Also, big news this week, the state legislature has dismantled the expert review panel that monitors the Highway 99 tunnel project. This is the panel that's independent of the legislature and independent of the project contractors. They ask questions of both sides. They give technical and financial advice. Why would a troubled project get even less oversight? Mike McGinn?
You know, I think you're really asking the wrong person here. No, seriously, I've been trying to understand this. This is like trying to ask the rebel commander why they put that air shaft on the top of the Death Star.
On the Death Star!
Why would they do that? You really have to speak to the architects of the Death Star to understand what they're thinking.
Yeah, the developers.
Well, it seems...
It turns out we have a couple here, by the way.
Right.
The legislature clearly feels like they don't want to know anymore. I think the rationale was that this could open the state up to litigation if they continue too much oversight and determine too many facts.
Yeah, but could you briefly explain that? What could the panel do that would put taxpayers more on the hook, theoretically?
I don't determine things that have happened by the contractor, for instance, that you can then sue them. But anyway, too much information often leads to lawsuits, and I guess they're just trying to avoid lawsuits here. But this entire project has become ridiculous. And now they want less oversight to protect themselves from litigation, I suppose. The fault here, of course, was doing this project in the beginning. They should have simply...
This is interesting.
I'll let Chris off the hook on this.
Yeah, see, Mike McGinn and Chris Vance feel that the project is ridiculous just for different reasons. Go on, Chris.
Yeah, well, yes. And my perspective, of course, is this is a state highway. It's not a Seattle city street. It's a highway that runs through the city of Seattle. You know, if you live where I live in the South End and you want to get to Bellingham, you might want to take Highway 99 to avoid I-5. We need more than one north-south Absolutely. Main road through the city of Seattle. It's not a Seattle city street. They should have simply rebuilt the viaduct, which they knew they could have done. It wouldn't have been as pretty, but it would have been certain. And now it's just massive cost overruns, and it's playing havoc with our traffic grid.
To the point of the expert review panel, clearly this is the lawyers talking and not saying the right things necessarily, because from what I've been hearing is that some of the expert review panel comments have been in favor of the contractor. So you don't want to put too much of that down on the record. That messes up future litigation. As for the long-term thing, and this, Mr. Mayor, I'm smiling at you as I say this. So you were right about the short term, that there would be construction problems, many of them. You weren't right about Seattle taxpayers being on the hook for it. But in the long term, we need that corridor. Mm-hmm. And so I'd rather be right in the long term.
And I'm certainly not going to revisit all the old debates here about what the solution should be or even the cost overruns. I think we're going to find that out. They're looking right now to reduce the amount of money for the surface street as one example and put that risk
on
the city.
But not coming at Seattle, as you said. Well, no, I haven't heard one person, absolutely zero people talking about putting that to Seattle taxpayers.
Right. Well, your predictions on the tunnel so far have been right on, so I'll listen to that one
too.
The point, but going to the expert review panel issue, and I was a lawyer in private practice for years and represented big companies and little companies in disputes. And when you start running your business or running your project in anticipation of the litigation, you're not doing it the right way. You know, as a lawyer, I would say to my clients, you run your business well, I'll advise you of the risks, and I'll help us get out of this litigation as quickly and cheaply as possible. But you have to run your business. And I think there's some red flags to that excuse, too. Judy Cliburn said
This is the transportation chair.
Yeah, the transportation chair said a red flag was that they were talking, the experts were talking to city council members. I personally would like city council members to have a greater understanding of what's going on with that project, instead of it being essentially a black box right now. We don't know why it broke, what it's going to take to fix it, or whether it will work. And we're being asked on faith to just push ahead. And I think a little more transparency and sunshine is in order, not secrecy.
Okay, so for listeners who haven't followed all of these machinations, but they know that they're taxpayers, the disappearance of this review panel means what to taxpayers? How should they feel about the fact that we just lost some amount of oversight of this project?
Well, if there's one ethic of our state that I think we all believe in, we want more information and more transparency. So getting rid of the expert review panel does not mesh with who we are. We want the information. We want the transparency.
I think Joni's right. And what this also could lead to is a lack of accountability. As this thing gets worse and worse, we're not going to be able to find out why and who caused it. But ultimately, and this is terrible, we're committed. I mean, there's a giant hole in the ground. They're not going to go back and fill it in. We're not going to now pursue the other options. We're going to build the freaking tunnel, no matter how long it takes or how much it costs.
And we'll be glad we did it in the long run.
And I think that's the attitude now of just, you know, we didn't want it this way, but now that we're committed, we just got to press on until we finish.
So Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, Speaker of the House in California, had a great quote. It was about a different project, but he said, you know, what we do, everybody knows these things aren't going to come in under budget. What we do is build a hole so deep that you just have to fill it in with money. And that's where we are right now, folks.
Before we move on, we
actually ought to take a close look at is there a reasonable likelihood of finishing this before committing to just pushing ahead and filling that hole with money.
Oh, so you're saying
another vote? Is that what you're calling for?
No, I'm not calling for another vote, but I really do think at some point you have to ask yourself, what is the potential future cost and is it worth it? And that would require actually having an understanding of what went wrong and what's the likelihood of success moving forward. Just saying trust WashDOT and trust the big companies, that's not a strategy. It's a faith-based strategy, and we're rejecting those in liberal Washington.
Who would stop this tunnel? How would that happen?
Well, the state. It's a state highway. It is governed by WashDOT and the governor and the legislature.
Odds that the state will stop this tunnel project are
probably zero.
I think it's very low, and I think that one of the things they want to do is just kind of keep a lid on this cost issue. Because I think going to the legislature and asking for more money is not going to go well when that happens.
Yeah, and one of the worst things about this, unfortunately, is this has now become a metaphor for people who don't want to support more revenue for transportation point to this project and see that's why. Every transportation project turns into a boondoggle. I don't want to vote for it. And so, therefore, transportation projects we really, really need don't get done.
Well, not every transportation project turns into a boondoggle.
No, but
Sound Transit's doing fine.
I understand, but people who don't want to support a gas tax increase, for instance, point to this hole in the ground and say, that's why I won't vote for it.
And, you know, there are a lot of transportation projects we don't need, and there's a lot of structurally deficient bridges we need to fix.
Yes.
And one part of the problem with the spending is we tend to put all the money towards the mega projects. There's something like in the state transportation bill, there's four times as much money for new projects as there is for maintenance.
They're so exciting.
Well, they really
this
are.
This is your idea
they
of
just
excitement?
Really are.
I'll go with that.
It's exciting from every point of view except actually in the tunnel where nothing is happening at all. to reset, the state legislature has dismantled the independent expert review panel that monitors the Highway 99 tunnel project and what could go wrong. Back in a moment on The Week in Review. And we're back, heading into the home stretch on KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. A Seattle man this week was ticketed for misleading drivers. Daniel Gelke saw Seattle police hanging out at a corner behind some ivy, positioning themselves to ticket motorists. He was annoyed by what he thought of as a sneaky speed trap. So he took out a Sharpie and scrawled on top of a white plastic container lid the words, "Cops ahead, stop at sign and light." And the cops pulled up on him.
What specific crime am I breaking, Officer Elliott?
5560, which is forbidden devices or signs.
Forbidden device. So I can't hold a sign?
Nope, you can't. Nothing that displays words that say stop, slow, turn, anything that gives directions, you can't do that.
How about careful? Is that a forbidden word to use? Officer Elliott?
I'll let you look it up,
he says. So the man got a $138 ticket because you can't have any structure, sign, light, or device that bears any such words as danger, stop, slow, turn, impound, or similar words, figures, or directions. A police spokesperson says a sign like that could be construed as regulating traffic. Who thinks this guy is not getting railroaded?
I think the cop is way off here because clearly, first of all, most people who see someone standing with a sign think it's probably someone asking for money. But if somebody was
and
able
they're avoiding
to see,
reading, they're avoiding eye contact.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Not
they're hardly
the
even looking at it. This is clearly free speech. I say this as someone who spends a lot of time in a speed trap. On Rainier Avenue under I-90. I've been there twice, same guy. I'm practically delivering lunch to the guy at this point. It's free speech. This is a weird reading of this thing.
Yeah.
First of all, I want to commend the cop because that was a really great particularized knowledge of the law. He cited the provision and the rules.
But they were polite. They were informed. It was a very nice stop. Now, you're supposed to defend the police.
I think a warning might have been sufficient. The cop was clearly annoyed by his speed trap being frustrated. But I also think that a little innovation and creativity here might be called for. I mean, I think this might be good summer youth employment. If you put people with those signs around the city, you'd both give people money and you'd slow down traffic a lot. So I don't think SPD is looking at this the right way.
I think what this points out and what everybody needs to remember all the time is every act in our criminal justice process is discretionary. The cops can choose to pull you over for going 56 miles an hour. The prosecutor can decide to charge you with a felony or a misdemeanor. So the laws are always broad enough that human judgment matters. So who we elect as sheriff, who we appoint as police chief, who we elect as prosecutor is important because they make decisions when to apply the law, when not to, when to stretch it, when not to. This is absurd. But people just need to – everything that happens in our criminal justice system is subject to human discretion, kind of like a soccer game where the referees get to interpret the rules.
Megan Rapinoe is not playing in the World Cup tonight.
Ridiculous call. USA tonight. We're going to beat China tonight. So.
So you may think it's absurd, but what is going to happen when this guy fights his ticket, as he says he's going to do, because the letter of the law is on those officers' side?
Well, there's the judgment.
Literally,
thing,
the letter's S-T-O-P of the law.
I'd advise him to get a jury trial on this one.
Exactly.
He could probably get that law nullified. Yeah.
Again, that's a judge and a jury will make a different decision, which goes to my point. Everything in this process is discretionary.
Everybody expects the context of what he's doing to come up and to be judged differently than this police officer is viewing it.
Now, I'll make a prediction. After this radio show and after the news, you might just see the city, if they're smart, change their course and just let this one go.
If you tell the court that you're a Week in Review fan, you'll be struck from the jury because you can no longer be impartial.
Yeah, I think they're going to have – absolutely. This one, the publicity on this one's through the roof.
Through the roof. Okay, so again, drivers who don't stop deserve tickets. Citizens who tell them to stop do not deserve tickets, according to our panel. This Seattle man says he's going to fight the ticket he got for telling drivers that police want them to stop where they're supposed to stop. We're almost to the end of the week in review. We're so glad to have you for the first time on this show, former Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn. How does it feel to not be mayor anymore, and what would you do differently from Mayor Ed Murray?
He said that with no time.
I needed that one at the top of the hour, Bill, not at the end. I've mostly refrained from giving advice, and I'll try to stick by that one. And I have to say, you don't know how stressed you are until you're not stressed. Yeah. So I've been enjoying life, and I got a good life in a great city with a great family. And thanks for having me on the show. I love it.
That was so... What's the deal with that little rule about how you don't criticize your predecessor?
I've broken it a couple of times.
Have you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But how come out on my show?
Well, we can work on that.
Okay. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Chris Vance, thanks for coming on.
Can we do this in Auburn next time?
I don't see why not. Joni Balter from Seattle Channel.
Thank you. I'd like to do it in the stop under the I-90 bridge next time.
Yeah, we're gonna get all your tickets erased if we keep up at this pace.
All is the right word, all.
And thank you, District 5's Northgate Community Center. Thank you, North Seattle. You know, you're not far from our next live event, which is going to be at the University Heights Center on July 17th. So you've got some time between now and July 17th to just come down south a little bit when we're in our next district neighborhood summer tour stop. I want to thank you, the KOW operations and event staff, on the Week in Review. Remember, we're at Twitter, at KOW. You can get our podcast. Go at KOW.org and download a podcast of the show. I'm Bill Radke, and we'll be back at you soon on the Week in Review.